Thank you all very much for coming this evening. A special thank you to those of you who are members of the Vancouver Institute. You know who you are. To those of you who are not members of the Vancouver Institute, I would invite you to become members. It's not expensive. $35 for a family, $25 for a single membership, and $10 if you're a student. Wonderful value. And if you would like to join this evening, our membership secretary will be sitting at the table as you leave, and she asked me to say either cash or checks. She doesn't have the machine with her tonight. So do keep that in mind if you're thinking about becoming a member. So thank you for that, and let me begin by saying that tonight is a very special night, not just for the Vancouver Institute, but also for Green College, in that tonight we present another Cecil and Ida Green lecture, and our speaker this evening, our guest, is the principal of Green Templeton College in Oxford, a college formed in 2008 by the amalgamation of Green College and Templeton College in Oxford. And of course, Green Templeton College is a sister college of our own Green College here. Like our own Green College, Green Templeton is a graduate college that owes its existence in large part to a benefaction by Cecil and Ida Green. Cecil, you may recall, was the UBC student who went on to found, among other things, Texas Instruments. He would be very happy to know that one of the colleges that bears his name is run by someone who understands the importance of big data. For, as you will already be aware, Denise Leavesley is a statistician by profession and a very distinguished one at that. Professor Leavesley was formerly the head of the School of Social Science and Public Policy at King's College London. And in her research, she focuses on the development of national and international policy on statistics and on the ethical use of statistical research in formulating public policy. She was founding director of UNESCO's Institute of Statistics, and she served as director of the UK Data Archive, the UK's largest collection of digital research data in the social sciences. Professor Leavesley has been president of the Royal Statistical Society, president of the International Association for Official Statistics, and president of the International Statistical Institute, the first woman to hold that office. Tonight, Professor Leavesley is going to address a question that is often asked in the realm of public debate. I think we are all familiar with the notion popularized by Mark Twain and others, that lying takes different forms. There are lies, there are damned lies, and there are statistics. Now I ask you, is this a reasonable proposition to put to a professional statistician without risk of personal injury? Would it be wise to ask a professional statistician whether statistics are just another form of alternative facts? The title of tonight's talk, Measuring the World, Should We Trust Statistics, is rife with possibility in this area. One thing I am sure of, though, Professor Leavesley is no female version of Mr. Gradgrind in Charles Dickens's Hard Times. People are not just numbers to her. And as you will see, she is very much concerned with the ways in which data may be used in addressing the problems faced by human beings around the world. Please join me in welcoming Professor Denise Leavesley.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'd like particularly to thank Green College for the invitation. I've had a lovely few days here at UBC. So, as has already been indicated, my topic, Measuring the World, is really built on the experience that I gained whilst I was Director of Statistics at UNESCO, and subsequently, for a while, I was Statistics Advisor to the head of the Economic Commission for Africa. So I'm very much talking from the perspective of a UN statistician. But let me start with global data and why data are important. So why are statistics important? And I thought that it would be a nice way to introduce the topic by showing you a film that I made when I was at UNESCO, that I'm pleased to say has been updated since then, that I think gives you an impression of the sort of statistics that I was involved in collecting. This is a way of cheating, data, so I don't have to talk so much.
More children than ever are going to primary school. In the year 2000, we made a promise. All children in school by 2015. Things were going well. By 2008, the number of children out of school dropped from 102 million to 60 million. Since then, progress has all but stopped. Today, there are 58 million children out of school. Half will never enter a classroom. The others will either drop out or will start late. In other words, close to 1 in 10 children are denied their right to education. They are the hardest to reach. Half of them live in sub-Saharan Africa, where the demand for education is growing. But who are they? Data tell us. They may be poor. In Burkina Faso, only 27% of rural girls go to school. They may already be working. There are some 168 million child laborers. The girls may be mothers. Every day, 39,000 girls under the age of 18 get married. Some may be disabled. More than 150 million children live with disabilities. They may be child soldiers. An estimated 250,000 boys and girls are involved in conflicts. Whatever the reason, we know these children have been marginalized through no fault of their own. Data tell us. Going to school can be a struggle. School is expensive. For every $100 invested by a government per pupil, parents pay an extra $10 to $70. It seems the poorer you are, the more it costs. Tuition is just the start. Many parents also pay for transportation, books, school supplies, and uniforms. Classrooms are overcrowded. In the Central African Republic, there can be 83 students per classroom. Conditions are poor. In Chad, most schools lack water, sanitation, and electricity. There are not enough textbooks. In Cameroon, 12 pupils can share a single book. There simply aren't enough teachers, let alone qualified teachers. Worldwide, 27 million teachers will be needed by 2030 to meet the growing demand for education. Data tell us. Every passing year, we are denying millions of children their right to education. So let's use the data to keep our promise. Education for all children.
So I hope that gives you a flavour of the sort of data that I was involved in collecting. And it's a good background to the talk that I'm going to give, which is about the difficulties of collecting such data and asking questions about whether or not we can trust those data. So I think it's obvious that statistics are fundamental for evidence-based policy and for decision-making. I think we'd all agree that we need statistics that we trust and that they're essential for a healthy society. Statistics are critical for helping people to make well-informed decisions. By putting the best available evidence, and note I don't necessarily say perfect evidence, at the heart of policy development and implementation. But I think it's also important that we use data to make explicit not just what's known, but also what isn't known. I think this quote from John Maynard Keynes is slightly tongue-in-cheek, but Nevertheless, I think it's quite interesting that he thought in terms of the difficulties of having evidence. We tend to talk about the positive aspects. So he talked about there being nothing that a government hates more than to be well informed, for it makes the process of arriving at decisions much more complicated and difficult. And I think we all know governments who feel like that, who would rather not have data, particularly when it's uncomfortable data. Now, I've concentrated on statistics for policy making, but statistics are also important as a tool of empowerment. They enable us, as citizens, to call our governments, to call our public servants, and so on, to account. You can really argue that they're part of the democratic system. They provide a window on society. And we all need statistics that are the currency of public debate. And I'll be coming back to that a few times. So why do we collect global data? Because all I've said could be true of national data, but why do we collect global data? Well, it's also for reasons of accountability, but in this case, it's accountability of national governments, but also of aid agencies and of the international agencies. But it's for other reasons too, for advocacy and resource mobilization. So the film that I showed you, that I made with colleagues at the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, was largely about raising issues relating to the problems of providing education for all across the world in order to get a resource mobilization for education. Global data are also important for comparative purposes. I believe very strongly that you understand yourself better through understanding others. So comparative research is really important. So how do we decide what to collect globally? Well, governments sign up to goals and commitments at a plethora of world and regional summits. And I think you'd probably be quite shocked at the number of these meetings that are taking place. So you hear about some of the big summits, but there are many, many other meetings taking place across the world, and governments sign up to goals there. They're also party to conventions and agreements, so conventions such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which all governments of the world signed up to, except for Sudan and the United States of America. And poorer countries of the world accept commitments as part of their aid packages. So they get funding from countries such as our own, and in return, they have to commit to making particular progress, and they get monitored in relation to that. Note that I don't say anything there about users of the data, really. I talk about the governments committing to these goals and so on. It's a very top-down process. So we have these goals, and they're then translated into targets, and then they're translated from targets into batteries of indicators, which statisticians, such as myself when I was in the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, which incidentally is based in Montreal, have to report on annually. And I guess you will all have heard of the Millennium Development Goals and the Sustainable Development Goals, which are probably the most well-known examples, but there are many, many other examples of goals being agreed to by governments. So that really dictates the global agenda for data. And as I say, it's very much top down, and the power has been held by the richer countries. There are some shifts away from the power totally being held by the richer countries towards actually taking account of the needs and requirements of the poorer countries of the world. And in particular, in relation to the Sustainable Development Goals, we see that there's goals there about the commitments of richer countries to help the poorer. But resource issues remain critical. And one of the difficulties we have is there's always a tension between globally determined and locally specific data. And the tools are owned by the richer countries. So the methodologies are often owned by the richer countries. An important question is whether global data are fit for purpose. That depends. I can't just answer that because there are multiple purposes for any one data set. And I could have given you many, many examples, but two particular examples is that the data requirements, if you're trying to make a best estimate for this point in time, is very different from the data requirements if you're interested in measuring change over time. And of course, in relation to the Sustainable Development Goals and Millennium Development Goals, we were interested in change on an annual basis from the benchmark year, 2000 in the case of the MDGs, 2015 in the case of the Sustainable Development Goals. So those are two different purposes, and different data sets would have different qualities in relation to that. And the whole issue of timeliness is also important. Timeliness always has to be balanced against other aspects of data quality. I can have more perfect data later if I put more resources and more time into collecting and analyzing those data, but maybe the data will be out of date. So getting this balance right between timeliness and other aspects of data quality is a critical one. And then, of course, in answering the question about whether global data are fit for purpose, we have to take account of the fact that statistical capacity and resources are very, very unevenly spread across the world. Let me take an aside, just for a minute, just to show you how complex it is, because that video sort of made it sound relatively straightforward. But how would you estimate the number of children, say the number of children of primary school age, out of school in the world? How would you begin to do that? Well, the first thing you'd need to do is you'd need to work out how many children there were, because you can't work out how many are out of school unless you know how many children there are. So that means that we need a good census. There aren't good censuses in many countries of the world. You need good administrative systems to carry out a good census. You need trust in the government. You need resources. You're measuring the number of children, small children, and censuses often get out of date. So you're going to have good vital registration as well as census data, again missing in many countries of the world. So problem number one is how many children there are. Problem number two is, right, to get the number of children out of school, we'll do it by taking them away, those children that are in school, away from the total number of children. Right, so we need to work out how many children are in school. That's easier than those out of school. How do we do that? Well, we need lists of the schools. We need to define what a school is. Is a madrasa a school? Is an evening class a school for children who are in work? So you need some definition of the schools. And a list of the schools. Then you've got the problem of how do you work out whether children are in school? Now, is it just children registered? No, because in some countries, teachers are paid according to the number of children registered. So there's great incentives for them to exaggerate. So children may be registered but not going to school. So we can't use registration. So we've got to go and collect data in some other way. maybe visiting the schools and seeing how many children are in. How often do you need to visit? How do you draw that sort of sample? And what do you do if children are sometimes in school but sometimes not? So it may be seasonal because they're taking animals to water. Or it may be that they're in school at the beginning of the year, but then money runs out in the family and they have to work. Lots and lots of things can affect it. But there may be things, aspects of this that you hadn't thought about, to do with defining schools, for example. I remember being in a discussion once about the fact that in Rwanda, children started school at the age of 7. And our definition of primary school age is usually 5 till 10. So are 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds out of school in Rwanda if there isn't school provided for them? And we had this discussion, and a lot of people, particularly from the richer countries of the world, insisted that 5- and 6-year-olds should be counted as being out of school in Rwanda. And then we pointed out that in Norway, school started at the age of 7. And somehow they didn't think that 5- and 6-year-olds were out of school in Norway. So all sorts of difficulties, and some of those become very political. And as you might imagine, I had quite difficult discussions with ministers of education about the figures that we came up with. No minister of education in China insisting that all children were in school. We didn't even know how many children there were. Saudi Arabia, the same. There the problem was not all girls were in school, not all children of guest workers were in school, but the Minister of Education insisted that all children were in school. What he meant was all Saudi Arabian boys were in school. So many aspects of the quality of data, and I haven't got time in my talk to go through all of these, but I just wanted to show you this slide because I think it's quite important to realise that there are many, many different aspects of quality of data. And that's why I say judging fitness for purpose is really difficult, because what data that will be fit for one purpose won't necessarily be fit for another. I'm going to take an aside and just read to you for a minute from an absolutely wonderful book, Inequality, by Anthony Atkinson. Anthony Atkinson was head of Nuffield College, a really important economist, and he died prematurely just a few weeks ago of cancer. This is what he says. In seeking to draw lessons from statistics on inequality, we have to be confident in the data of the quality of the data we're using. This is why I begin this chapter by describing and evaluating the sources of evidence on which scholars of inequality can draw. Such scrutiny is essential. All too often, economists race ahead, drawing conclusions from figures that happen to be there without asking whether the data are suitable. This is all the more important given the explosion of data. The famous study in the mid-50s by Simon Kuznets, the Nobel Prize-winning Harvard economist, of the evolution of income inequality over time was based on a handful of data points for a small range of countries. Today, there's a profusion of data sets. This represents a great improvement and is tribute to the substantial efforts of statistical officers. At the same time, we risk being overwhelmed. We need to ask, where do the different data come from, and why do they sometimes tell us different stories? He goes on to talk a little bit later in the same chapter about comparability being key to research. The statement that inequality in one country is lower than it is in another is of limited meaning if the underlying statistics are not collected on a comparable basis. We can't draw immediate conclusions about differences in inequality if in country A, incomes are recorded in a household survey for the household as a whole, whereas in country B, they're drawn from individual income tax records, and so on. It's a quite wonderful book. You can't measure the world without comparable data. Doesn't make sense. You have to add together data for different countries. You can't add together apples and pears. So comparable data is essential if we aggregate across boundaries. It's also essential if we examine change over time. And that's what the MDGs and the SDGs are all about. They're about examining change over time. But we have this tension that we lose relevance to local or current circumstances in the process, and that the data might not be owned or recognized locally. So the dangers are what I call data imperialism. And it's a problem. So thinking about comparability, both over time and over space, a good friend of mine talks about comparability being only skin deep. And there are many, many challenges to comparability. And I've just put some of them up there. I'm sure that you could think of other challenges to data comparability too. So huge problems. Let me move on to a slightly different topic, and that is that of trust. As an important topic at the moment, isn't it, with all the debate taking place about post-truth society and so on. A prerequisite for global data to be of use is that the data must be trustworthy. But it isn't enough that the data are trustworthy, they also have to be trusted. And that requires something different about our societies. If data aren't trusted, they won't be used, and there'll be fights about the data rather than about the issues. And I think we're all familiar with that circumstance. I'm reading a really great book at the moment by Anthony Seldon called Trust. And I really like these two quotes from it. That trust is necessary for good government. A government which is trusted has higher levels of legitimacy, and there's a greater willingness of its citizens to comply with its rulings. This is what I was talking about earlier in terms of whether there could be census data. If you haven't got legitimacy from the government, you're not going to get people complying with census or surveys or submitting administrative data to the government. But also, Anthony talks about the fact that government has to trust the people too. A government that doesn't trust the public hems it in with mechanisms of accountability and surveillance. We've seen this problem happening in the UK, particularly in relation to the National Health Service, where government starts to get huge systems of regulation and so on. And what's happened there is a lack of trust with the professionals. So should we trust global data? There's quite an interesting book called Poor Data, which looks at the quality of data in Africa. And Morten Jensen, in that book, says that data users have no a priori basis for judging which of the data sets are better than others. Only seasoned country experts can reasonably judge the quality of a country's data. I might agree with him, but when I was a UN statistician, I had responsibility for collecting data for 220 countries of the world. Pretty difficult to start to understand the individual context of each of those countries. And if you're looking at the global data, the compilation of data from those 220 countries, how you would make judgments about the quality is problematic. There are lots of reasons not to trust the data, in part because they're usually sourced from national data. So the data I was talking about relating to children in school, that depends upon lists from the government about schools, right? So when I'm evaluating whether I trust data from an individual country, I start to look at the statistical process. So what I would call process evaluation. I look at whether there's good statistical practice in the country. And there are many aspects of that. And you might like to think about it in relation to Statistics Canada, you know, and in relation to the decision that was made about the long-form census here by Stephen Harper and the impact that had on the reputation, because I can tell you it did have a huge impact on the reputation of Statistics Canada internationally. So the whole issue about sort of autonomy or independence of the statistical office, the appointment of the head of the office and whether that's divorced from the political process. It isn't in the United States. We are waiting to hear who the head of statistics will be. The external auditing processes, systems, whether there are codes of conduct that are adhered to, whether the country is signed up to the UN principles of official statistics, etc. There are many ways in which you can judge whether you've got good statistical practice. I think the crunch points, the really critical issues, are whether the statisticians are shielded from undue political pressure, and what happens when they produce uncomfortable results. Are those results published? Or are they hidden in some way? Or, even in some countries, changed? So do the politicians seek to distort the results? Do they produce alternative facts? Do they try and undermine the results by ridiculing the statisticians or the media? And the critical issue is the relationship of statisticians to the media. So I think these issues have greater resonance for us over the last few months. Before then, I would have thought I was talking about some of the poorer countries of the world only. I couldn't resist putting this slide in. I don't know if you know that Tom Hanks has just sent a coffee machine to the White House press corps. And he pinned this to the coffee machine. Keep up the good fight for truth, justice, and the American way, especially for the truth part. So I used the term poor data earlier, and Dimitri Sanger, who I used to work with in the Economic Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa, says of the MDGs that a major weakness is the assumption that data would be available. Countries have been struggling to build their capacity to collect, process, and disseminate the requisite data. A huge, huge issue. It is getting better. The MDGs have shone a light on this, and we see much more attention being paid to statistical capacity within countries. So I am an optimist in this respect. It is improving. But I think one of the questions we have to ask that relates to the trust issue is whether we trust the international agencies. So what do the international agencies who are compiling the global data do if they suspect data corruption? And are they sometimes complicit in accepting poor data? One of the things that I've done in my past is reviewed the quality of the economic data in Greece that was used in order for the for Greece, first of all, to join the EU, but then subsequently to join the European Monetary Union. That was quite explicit corruption of those data, and the European Union was complicit in accepting those data. Jan of van der Mortel claims that statistics have been used to fabricate the success of the Millennium Development Goals. He also claims that the targets have promoted a one-dimensional view of development and have strengthened the rather money-centric and donor-centric view of development, his words. One of the things we need to do in thinking about whether we trust data is understand incentives. Governments are both monitoring the public services and being monitored by the data they produce, the national data and the global data. And many of the data are expressed as targets, as I've already mentioned. Some of the international agencies, and indeed some of the aid agencies, use the data for naming and shaming. Or they use the data putting countries in league tables of performance. The Royal Statistical Society has quite an outstanding report that it produced some years ago, but it's still very pertinent to this issue of performance monitoring. And they called the report The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, which is a lovely way of summing up performance indicators. As a statistician, I'm quite conflicted, because performance indicators have raised the profile of statistics. And of course I believe in good monitoring, but I'm also worried that they have led to distortion of lots of data. And Goodhart's law is that when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to become a good measure. Again, I couldn't resist putting that in, even though it doesn't relate to global data. But, we often have to collect data on topics that it's extraordinarily difficult to define. So this is goal 16 of the Sustainable Development Goals. I don't think any of us could disagree with this goal. It's for peace, justice, and strong institutions. And the goal is to promote peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development, to provide access to justice for all, and to build effective, accountable, and inclusive institutions at all levels. I feel very sad for the statisticians that have got to turn that goal into targets and then indicators. And one of the difficulties you have is that sometimes if it's hard to measure something that's really important, we end up measuring something else. I used to have responsibility when I was Director of Statistics at UNESCO for monitoring adult illiteracy across the world. Right? So one of the goals, of the Millennium Development Goals, was or one of the targets, rather, was to halve adult illiteracy between 2000 and 2015. Very, very worthy goal. A few problems with it. One of them was we had no idea what adult illiteracy was in the year 2000. So actually, halving it by 2015 was somewhat difficult. You don't have a very good estimate as to adult illiteracy in Canada with your wonderful Statistics Canada. It's a very difficult thing to measure. And you can only really measure it with sample surveys. And then you have the problem that you risk mistaking the signal for the noise. Sorry, the noise for the signal when you're comparing two years of data, because they're both sample-based. So there will be changes year on year, but are they real changes, or are they artifacts of the fact that you've got a new sample, or maybe your methodology's changed slightly? When I was working on adult illiteracy, I visited Papua New Guinea. Some of you may know that Papua New Guinea has 452 languages. I don't quite know what adult illiteracy means in a country that has that many languages, never mind how, as a statistician, I would start to measure it, and to measure it in a way that is then comparable with another country. So what did we do? What we did instead, because we couldn't measure this well, was we took an indicator that was completely different, which was 5 years of primary education, because we could measure that reasonably well in most countries. So we knew what proportion of the population had had 5 years of education. I was then reading a World Bank report in which the authors said, we've been really unfair about education systems in the poorer countries of the world, because we've said that many of these education systems don't actually deliver quality education. But actually, we've found there's almost perfect correlation between 5 years of primary education and adult literacy. I did write to them. I didn't receive a response. But the other problem we have is that we then often devote our resources to achieving the wrong target. We have unintended consequences. We have what we call hitting the target but missing the point. The danger with a measurement culture is that we pay excessive attention to what we can easily measure at the expense of what's difficult or impossible to measure quantitatively, even though that may be fundamental. And as a statistician, I think that should be my little prayer at night, that this is an issue. Some of you may be familiar with this absolutely brilliant quote from Robert Kennedy, where he talked about the gross national product not allowing for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. Doesn't include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. It's just a wonderful quote. One of my colleagues had just taken her children to see, I think it's something like Batman and Lego or something. I don't know. We've got anybody in the audience can tell me what the film is, but something like that. And apparently the hero of that film achieves something remarkable, and they're asked how they've achieved it, and they say, with statistics and compassion. So I have decided that it's now going to... She came back from the film and she said, I should have it as my logos, with statistics and compassion. Sarkozy, he set up a commission under Joe Stiglitz, Amartya Sen, and Fattouzi, who was the head of statistics in France at that time. A commission on the measurement of economic performance and social progress. The reason why he set up this commission was because he was very worried that France was always being compared badly against Germany, because Germany achieved so much more economically than France. And he felt that the quality of life in France was so much better than it was in Germany. And so he set up a commission to show that we shouldn't just look at economic data. That report is a very valuable report and has been very influential, and was actually influential in the discussions of moving from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals. Concerns about the adequacy of the current measures of economic performance, particularly those based on GDP, the relevance of the figures, and the overemphasis on economic growth. So that has been very important. And the move from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals have been about this, about concerning over an unrelenting pursuit of growth at the expense of the environment, and that they don't take enough account of inequalities within our societies. I'm guilty of that. I used to collect data on a national basis for 220 countries of the world, but data relating to Vanuatu at a national level is somewhat different from national data relating to Brazil. Inequalities within countries as a critical issue. And the SDGs are really about giving visibility to disenfranchised in our societies. David Boyle's Tyranny of Numbers, he talks about the paradox. If we don't count something, it gets ignored. If we do count it, it gets perverted. So, economists have come to feel what can't be measured isn't real. The truth is always an amount. Count numbers, only numbers count. Lord Kelvin talked about this and says, if you can't express yourself in terms of numbers, your knowledge is of a meager kind. Figures have a spurious credibility and are wielded like weapons, I'm afraid. I just want to say that numbers aren't the only things that are powerful. Photos can be really powerful too, can't they? And I want to show you just a little bit of work of somebody called Hans Rosling. A good friend of mine talks about the amount of data in the world that's untouched by human mind. That data, global data, gets collected and it sits in fusty volumes of statistics on shelves and it doesn't get used. We need to get much better in telling stories with data. We need much better communications across with the media. And somebody who has done amazing work on this topic is Hans Rosling, who, like Tony Atkinson, died just a few weeks ago prematurely of cancer, which I am devastated by. He's a close friend of mine. And I'm going to show you one of his slides, but then my next slide after this is just a reference to a YouTube. And if you do one thing after this talk, would you go and watch that YouTube of Hans Rosling? Because I can't sing about data in the way that he sings about data. He was just remarkable. So I'm going to show you, but I can't do it like he can. Could. I can't believe he's gone. So I just need to explain this a little bit, and then I'm going to leave you to watch it, right? So he's got life expectancy in years against income per person, the GDP per capita, adjusted for inflation and prices. So he's taken, in effect, World Bank adjusted data in order to allow for differences across countries. Each of the bubbles on there is a country. The countries are, the size of the bubble is proportionate to the size of their population. So green there, you can see they're highlighted, are the Americas. Blue, the Africa. Red, Asia. And yellow, Europe. Okay, so that's what the situation was in 1800. So you've got 1800 across. And what this does, this projection, is it shows you how that's changing over time. So what I want you to look at, because I won't speak whilst it's on, is I want you to see how the different groups are moving relative to one another. I'd like you to particularly look at where China and India, so the big red blobs, end up. You can see that Africa is lower. You can see where are we? That's the United Kingdom there. Italy. Okay, so you can see, I'm happy to show you any particular countries if you want. I think the other thing that's worth noting is world wars and economic recessions. So you'll see some changes suddenly happening as a result of those. So let me show you. So countries are getting richer, but they're not. Life expectancy isn't changing a lot. You saw the war. Look at China and India. Wow, they suddenly come across, don't they? It's absolutely startling. Do you want me to show you it again? Central African Republic, down there, if anybody wanted to know. Saudi Arabia, United States, obviously. Canada's hidden, I'm afraid. It's the green behind here, look. Ah, I can't even get to it, but it's the green that's hidden behind. So up near the United States. I have to get back. The YouTube is called Don't Panic, and it's showing the facts about population. And it's quite a startling YouTube. One of the reasons why I really like it is he doesn't just show the data, but he also has carried out surveys about people's perception of the data in the United Kingdom, and shows how the population of the United Kingdom do worse than monkeys in guessing the right answers in relation to population growth, and particularly things like average family size and so on. And he then disaggregates within the UK population those who are at UK universities from the rest of the population, and shows how those at university do worse than the rest. So it's quite startling. Thank you very much for your invitation and your attention.
Now you can. Professor Livesey has agreed to take questions for the next 10 or 15 minutes, so if you have a question, please stick up your hand, and she's promised to repeat the question for the rest of the audience.
I'm curious, does Statistics Canada regain any of its former?
Yes, it has. It has. I forgot, just 2 minutes. Has Statistics Canada redeemed any of the impact to its reputation? It certainly has. And I think those people in the know really appreciate that it's one of the best statistical offices in the world in relation to its methodology. What we were startled about was political interference in what should be a professional decision. And so given that and given that's been changed, yes, it has redeemed. But it was a shock. It was a shock that reverberated right across the statistical system. Please. Statistics coming out of war zones. Yeah. One of the things I didn't talk about, which I could have done, I could have spent a lot of time on, in fact, is the problem of missing data. So if you're producing global data and you've got countries where there is no data because of wars or because of famines, we've no data at the moment for Sudan, we've no data for Syria. The difficulty is that you haven't got data in a country because of a particular circumstance, often because of major change in that country. And you can argue it's the time when you actually want more data from those countries rather than none or very little. So it is a problem. And one of the things that when you're using global data you need to be very aware of is how the agency has treated missing data. Because some agencies just assume it's missing at random. And in effect, missing at random means that it's like the average. Well, no, by definition, it isn't like the average. A better estimate would be to assume that it's like the worst you've got. The worst countries you've got data for. And some agencies will try and produce some sort of uncertainty. So it is hugely problematic. To get data in such circumstances is very hard. Yeah, please. The question is, with the internet, is it getting easier to collect data? Depends if you're talking about nationally or globally. Globally, much easier to collect data because most of the statistical offices across the world now have electronic means of delivering the data to you. You imagine in the past, you were waiting to get data from somewhere like the Central African Republic without electronic means. It was extraordinarily difficult. So from the perspective of global data, it's much easier now. And the perspective of national data, it depends, because many countries we're talking about, countries such as war zones or countries in famine or whatever, the populations that you're interested in, the marginalized in the world, do not have access. So that's difficult. There's also, I guess you may be aware, there's just been a major problem with the census in Australia. And the census in Australia was done electronically, and there was major electronic failure. And the census was really disrupted as a result of that. It'd probably be the weakest census they've had for many years. So we shouldn't assume that even when we do things electronically, it's positive. There can be problems. I've got a few at the back, so right at the back. Assess the impact of open data. It hasn't made a huge difference to national statistical offices because they're still, in the main, they're collecting data in many of the conventional ways that they did. What it has made a difference to is access to that information, challenge to that information. An important aspect of quality is allowing people to challenge it, people on the ground who know to say this doesn't look right, so non-governmental organisations and so on to challenge. So I think it's a really important part of transparency of statistical systems and it helping us to improve. Yes? Yes? Yep. And now it's 7. All I could say to you, I mean, I've got a really good answer to you. Please watch Hans Rosling's YouTube, because this is exactly the issue that he addresses. So for those of you who didn't hear, it's about the relationship of population growth in relation to the data and the relationship to poverty. It's absolutely fantastic demonstration of that. So it's his, that wasn't mine, that was Hans Rosling. I can't take credit for that. It was produced in the context and the knowledge of that. And if you look at the Fuller YouTube, it's about an hour on YouTube. It's just stunning. And that's exactly the issue he addresses. Please. Sorry? Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a question, although I can do this succinctly. In the postmodern world, science has been assaulted and is being assaulted now in a number of political environments. Your particular presentation, to me, can also be included in a troubling kind of way, given the fact that much of science is under assault right now. So my question to you is, in your experience working with political leaders, statisticians, agencies around the world, World Bank, what have you found to be the best method? It's not perfect, I'm sure, probably a long ways away, that you actually can take some
I could give you lots of examples of that. The best. I've worked particularly in crime data in the United Kingdom, where people's perception of crime is very different from the data. And actually, working through the data with somebody, you can reassure them in many ways in relation to that data. So I don't know if that's the sort of thing you meant. I didn't repeat the question because I assumed that you could all hear the question. The politics of numbers is really a very complex one. And I mean, I'm not, in general, in favor of shaming countries in relation to misuse of data. I'd much, much rather work with countries for them to understand that actually, if they have better data, they can produce better policies and they're going to have more impact. And so you may call me naive, but that's the approach that I've taken.
Reduce threat.
Work much more on carrots. And I think we've got another one up here and then come down. Yes?
Requesting the data, acquisition, the processing, and then reporting. Language surely must be a large problem. How do you overcome that?
Right. So, any of you in Montreal, go and visit the UNESCO Institute for Statistics. Language was the question. How do you cope with collecting data from 220 countries of the world in terms of language? The statisticians across those countries speak 5-6 main languages. So we would make sure that we had all of our questionnaires and we had staff that could speak those key languages. So my example of Papua New Guinea and 452 languages, you don't need to speak that many languages. We had staff that spoke, I think, 6 languages. And we had a rota system so that we worked through the night, so people were working in the time zones of the countries they were dealing with. And increasingly, using Skype and other methods in order to connect with statisticians in the countries. But it also involved a huge amount of travel. I mean, whilst I worked for UNESCO, I traveled an average of 2 countries every week. So a lot of travel to connect, to create the community. You can't ask people for data unless they understand why and how.
Just one more question. The United States has demonstrated an exemplary history of collecting and disseminating data. What recourse do we have when it appears that the current administration in the United States will be stopping the collection of some data, hiding or distorting?
Question about the United States and the wonderful history that they have of collecting and disseminating data. Things like the ICPSR, which is one of the first data archives of the world. What recourse do we have now in respect of them stopping collecting data or distorting it? Well, I put up some of the processes. I think international vigilance, providing a community for the statisticians in the United States is important. The UN Statistics Commission starts in New York this Monday. The international community of statisticians and supporting one another is absolutely critical. Exposing if there are problems. Having said that, I'm not complacent, and I know that there are statisticians working in the United States who are worried about whether they should destroy some of the identifiable information in case it's misused. So they're getting worried of that in that way. I have been in a situation where friends of mine who've been heads of national statistics offices have talked to me about threats made to their families by government if they didn't distort the data. And what would you say to somebody in that situation? I mean, nobody is going to put their children at risk. I've been to visit statisticians who live in exile because they refuse to do what the government required. One of the things that I'm hoping to do at some point is to write a book on trust, and one of the people I've been interviewing is living in exile from the country where they were head of the National Statistics Office because they were put under pressure to change the GDP data and to change the unemployment data and refuse to do so. So people get quite surprised that statistics are that critical, that important, but they are, and they are really critical to governments. And the incentives go in both directions, right? There are incentives to make things look more positive and make show that you've made progress. There are also incentives to show that you're poorer in order to get more aid. And I've actually been in a country where in the morning we've had a meeting with USAID, and the country has wanted to show progress because that's what the US decides. And in the afternoon, we've had a meeting with the Norwegian aid agency, and they fund the poorest countries of the world, and a different set of statistics have been produced by the government. And do you blame them? This is in order to maximize the money for their country, and there's a poor country. There are incentives to do this. That's the difficulty.
Thank you. And now I'm going to call upon... I'm going to call upon Dr. Mark Vesey, Principal of Green College, UBC, to thank Professor Leavesley on our behalf.
Thank you, Herbert. My colleague, Herbert Rosengarten, didn't mention that I'm also Professor of English. That may be just out of natural modesty, since he is too. I'm not a social scientist, and I've realized this week that my education in statistical methods is quite inadequate too. And one reason I know that now is that I made the mistake of attempting to administer a sample survey at Green College a couple of nights ago after Professor Leavesley had given her talk. I said, just as a matter of curiosity, members of the audience, how many of you, and this is, I should say, is an interdisciplinary, cross-sectoral audience like the one at the Vancouver Institute on nights like this. Students, faculty members, members of the public with all kinds of different trainings and backgrounds and experience. I said, how many of you would say that your work involves analyzing data? And I thought there might be 20, 30%. No, I'm not going to do it tonight because once bitten, twice shy. I thought at most, I mean, allowing for the fact that some people have come because the speaker is a professional statistician, it couldn't be more than 40 or 50%. 95% of the audience raised their hands, leaving me and, you know, four others professing not to work with data. You know, where were all the people at UBC and elsewhere who work with people, ideas, texts, subatomic particles? I mean, they hadn't left the room. The room was still packed. What I realized, the first thing I realized instantly, was that's not a question you ask an audience after they've heard Professor Leavesley. Far better to ask it beforehand, when the room is still full of skeptical people who wouldn't consider for a moment describing themselves as data scientists. Once she's finished, well, of course, everybody wants to be a data scientist. I think that was a large part of my mistake. But then it occurred to me there's something else going on as well. I mean, has there ever been a time before now when it's been more likely that as a human being one would take oneself or mistake oneself for some kind of semi-organic data processor. That a human being is a place, a site, where multiple data streams intersect. We are constantly receiving and retransmitting data in different medias. Organic processes that we are accessorized in so many new ways with inorganic prostheses, which at times we can't even unplug. This is a great moment, if it's not too late, to think about what it means to be a human data processor. It may even be a critical moment to do that. One thing that's become clear again, much clearer this evening, is that, well, as Professor Leavesley said, data untouched by human minds are useless. But of course, there are actually no data untouched by human minds. Until human minds come along, there aren't any data in the world. The world is not comprised of data, whatever the stuff is that makes it up. The data is a product of human segmenting of reality. And I'm sorry if you think this is just another bankrupt postmodernist speaking, I'm going to have to plead guilty. The word world itself, the root, the Germanic root of the word world includes the word for a human being. Now, it happens to be a male human being, but you know that Germanic root goes a long way back. We've updated a lot of things, but our world is still human and social. And our facts are still ineluctably social, both in their production and, of course, in their transmission, reception, and interpretation. And one of the quotes that I'm going to come away with this evening, if I can find it in my own prosthetic inorganic data processing instrument, which is this notebook I carry around with me, is a quotation of Professor Leavesley to the effect that we need, all of us, not just professing data scientists, to get much better at telling stories with data and communicating them through media, whichever media we happen to command. Because as we discovered, pre- and post-Brexit, pre- and post-Trump, it doesn't matter how much expert data are put out there. If nobody trusts them, believes them, believes in them or acts upon them, you're not really going to get anywhere. We have had our work cut out for us again, I think. A night at the Vancouver Institute isn't a night out or an evening off. Well, it may be those things. It's also an assignment. Whatever our professions, we have to conspire somehow to communicate the media that science provides to us. The arts of data management, for which we're all more or less equipped, have become suddenly critically more important. For affirming that fact and providing us with new resources for reckoning with it, our thanks go to Professor Leavesley. It's not just been a big week at Green College, it's been a great week for the Vancouver Institute.
Don't forget to come next week for the natural history of polar bears.
Thank you.